Welcome to the Home Stretch Podcast, where we interview world champions, Olympians, and just amazing overall people who have accomplished amazing things. We want to hear their stories directly from them so we can get tidbits and learn the keys to success and figure out how we can win as well. We have another special guest today, Bahamian triple jumper, Levan Sands. How you doing, Levan?
Doing good. That's Levan Superman Sands.
Oh, no, no. You know what? I wrote it down to say the nickname. I kind of messed that up. Levan Superman Sands joins us today, and Ashley joins us as well. Welcome back, Ashley. Thank
you. Since it's Olympic season, we should preface our names with Olympian.
Levan Sands. Oh, yes. Olympian
Kelly, Olympian Adrian. Thank you.
Yes, we should. Yeah. We're going to put the OLY next to all of our names to get this right. Put the respect out there. Olympian Ashley.
That's right. We all Olympians. That's right.
That's right. Put Caribbean. Some respect on it. You got some Caribbean Olympians here, folks. Yeah, get it right. That's it. So a little bit about Levan's background, in case you don't know. Levan born in Nassau, Bahamas. He's a four-time Olympian. He was a bronze medalist at the 2003 World Championships and the 2002 Commonwealth Games. He got bronze at the 2008 Olympic Games, where he hit a personal best and a Bahamian national record in a triple jump of 1759. That's 57 feet, 8.5 inches. Ridiculous. He got fifth place in the 2012 London Olympics. And we're going to go into the story a little later on that. 13 times national champion. He ran at Auburn University, where he was a school record holder in the triple jump, the outdoor long jump as well. Two NCAA titles, All-American honors four times. I mean, just your resume is crazy, as expected of an Olympic medalist. I know, just the whole thing, reading it off. So thanks for joining us, Levan. I'm going to be honest, you're one of my favorite triple jumpers. I loved watching you compete, you know, especially being from the Caribbean. You know, being from the Caribbean as well, man, seeing you live and direct, repping the Caribbean and you know, winning medals and stuff, man. I always have to rep the Caribbean folks, man, who can come from our little islands and you know, represent on the world stage and win. So it's amazing.
No, seriously, that's huge. That's huge. You know what I mean? Yeah. When you think about how many people on the island, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and you're competing against the world.
Yeah, and USA, which is just ridiculous all the time. Right? So, Levan, thanks for joining us. Tell us how you got started in track. Every time I talk to Caribbean folks, I like to ask about their specific country because we're all so different. You know, the USVI is a little different from the BVI and the St. Kitts. We talked to Kim, very different from the culture in Jamaica where they're running from like 1 year old to, you know. So how was it in the Bahamas? Was track a big thing?
Yeah, track was always a big thing. My daddy was a black belt and I started doing karate at first, and he thought about it, and he was like, "Man, he don't think karate is going to get us a scholarship to go off to university." So when I was five, he always had this thing where he told all the, you know, he was a police officer, and you know, me as a lanky little boy, skinny little boy, he always had this thing where he told officers that one day my son is going to go to the Olympics, and he's going to be an Olympic medalist or whatever, you know. So there was this truck in my neighborhood. You know, in the Bahamas, this truck used to pass by our house every day. And he had like a bunch of people on the back of the truck. And one day my dad stopped them. He stopped them and he was like, what are you guys doing? You know, I see y'all pass my house every day with all these kids on the back of the truck. So the coach, he was a coach at the time. Coach Stephen Murray was driving the truck and he stopped and talked to my old man. And he said, it's a track team. KFC Striders. And so my old man told him, say, look, man, I got two sons. I would like for them to maybe start join the track club, you know, and that's how I got started. I was five or six. And me and my brother started.
You know what I heard when you said that the truck was coming through the village every day? That your dad stopped it and said, like, let me see if my son could beat you to the end of the street. That's what the first thing that came to my head. I thought that's where the story was going. But who knows?
No. Yeah, it was full of kids and teenagers. So, you know, and he had these benches going across for you to sit on. So they used to sit on the benches across the truck and it used to be like in rows. And then, so he, I guess we started track after that, after, you know, after that conversation. And then that was all she wrote. And then I started, you know, with the club. And I was doing, I was running, throwing. You know, when you're that young, they have you doing everything. So I didn't really figure out. I mean, I always knew I could jump, but, you know, I was actually more of a runner, 400-meter runner, 200 meters, and 400-meter runner. So I should have been a 4x4 relay, too.
Well, you know, you hit on something early that I always like to point out, that everybody that I've spoken to through this podcast and even in real life, people who are successful, everybody has somebody, one person that's really behind them, pushing them, who really believes in them. And, you know, I feel like, and I spoke about this just recently, we all can be that somebody for somebody, you know?
Yeah.
We all can be that somebody who believes in somebody to the point that it motivates them to achieve greatness. And so I had a quote here that I saw from you that I did want to read. You were saying, this is a quote from you. Before I was an Olympian, and it is about your dad. Before I was an Olympian, he always said I was going to be one. When I became an Olympian, he always said I was going to be a medalist. He always had this strong faith and belief that I was something greater. I've had so many ups and downs, but through all of the downs, he was always right there, pushing me to keep going and keep striving for greatness.
That's my old man, bro. You know, I get a little sensitive when they talk about him, you know what I mean? But he believed in me more than I believed in myself, you know what I mean? So I give him all the props, you know what I mean, for my success, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
It's hard for me to talk about him. So,
yeah,
you know what I mean? But he's been my greatest motivation, you know, and my whole life, you know what I mean? Like that one person who just believed, you know, that one person just believed you was extraordinary, you know what I mean, or superhuman.
Mm-hmm.
So he always, every time I doubted myself, he always told me, you could do this. And or he would give me some incentive, like say, okay, if you win the Carifta Gold, I'm going to give you $300.
That's big incentive.
I'd be like, you sure you want to bet me? All right, then watch this. And I would always take his money. You know what I mean? So that was his way of motivating me, you know what I mean? Because he knew that I love money, or I always wanted to buy some. My thing is, I wanted to buy some Jordans and stuff, right? So he said, okay, well, you can work for it. You know, you get a goal, I'm going to give you $300. And he made sure, you know, he had the money in my hand, you know what I mean? So that was his way of pushing me, you know what I mean? Everybody got their own ways, you know, so that's how he pushed me.
Yeah, I feel like incentive is good for kids, you know? You give them something, they're like, oh, hey, yeah, $300. You know how much that is for a kid?
That's what I said. So I would always take his money, you know what I mean? He always bet me on those stuff, and I would always take his money, you know what I mean?
So when did you start triple jump?
All right, so all those years, from 5, 6 years old, like I said, I was running. I was doing the 100, 200 meters, and 400. And I was pretty decent leading up to, you know, sixth grade. I was one of the best in elementary school in the whole of the Bahamas. And I just found out when I got to seventh grade that I wasn't really that good. You know what I mean? I trained, you know, as hard as I trained, you know, I guess, when I got to high school, I had a scholarship, you know, at Temple Christian, but it didn't go as well as I thought. I was hoping it would have went, and they told me that they was going to take my scholarship away. And so immediately, this was in the eighth grade, they told me they was going to take my scholarship away because some of the parents were complaining that some of their kids who was a little older than me, that they were better than me and they didn't have a scholarship.
Yeah.
So I remember I went to the car. You know, I was young. I cried, you know what I mean? Because I know my parents couldn't really afford, you know, the school fee or whatever. So, you know, I cried about that and stuff like that. And then it was then when I started looking for, in the eighth grade, I started looking for a coach to coach me, you know what I mean, for running. So that's when I came across, my daddy came across Henry. Henry was a coach, Henry Roll. He was a coach at St. John's College. It's a high school in the Bahamas. And he saw me and he said, man, this guy is tall and lanky. I'm going to teach him how to jump, train him how to jump. And so I started training for long jump and triple jump. But I always long jumped, but I started training for triple jump during that time. And the first time I triple jump in the eighth grade, I jumped 44 feet, 4 inches. Mm. And so everybody was like going like crazy, like, man, that's a far jump. You jumped 44 feet in the eighth grade. And I didn't know how far it was. I didn't have no form or anything. You know what I mean? And so I started training for it. And 2 years later, 10th grade, I made my first career team at 15 years old. And I got a gold medal in the triple jump. I jumped, 47.8 or something like that. My first career, I won in Barbados and won my first gold. And then everything started catapulting from there. It started going up from there.
So you folks who have been following should know what CARIFTA is at this point. We've had enough Caribbean athletes here to explain what CARIFTA is. If you win in a CARIFTA goal, you're somebody in the Caribbean for sure. The best of the best of the best. You're a CARIFTA. I mean, that's you want to win that meet. Definitely.
Yeah, the best goes to CARIFTA.
And 44 feet at eighth grade when you just start triple jumping, like, come on, man. That's unreasonable. You know, if you would have said 40 feet, I'd be like, oh man, that's a good start. I just went out and jumped 44 feet my first time in eighth grade. Like, what?
I didn't know what I was doing. My form was terrible. I'm talking about no hop, no step. And I'm talking about standing up and on the landing, standing up. I was standing up jumping 44 feet and not knowing how far it really was. Because I was, you know, I was only like 14.
Yeah, the coaches were going crazy. They're like, oh my God.
Yeah, it was like, man, you were triple jumping. I'm like, okay.
And then shout out to Coach Rhodes too. I assume that's like one of the reasons you went to Auburn.
Oh yeah. So, you know, from that point on, you know, through CARIFTA, 97, 98, two bronze in 98, my first senior year, and then double gold in 99 and double gold in 2000. And so I promised, he was recruited. At that point, he was at Auburn by the time I became a senior. And so he had been recruiting me ever since. And so me and my parents had already promised him that, you know, Auburn was going to be the one place that we were going to sign to. So that's how I ended up at Auburn.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And well, before you went to Auburn, you were at JUCO, right?
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, I went.
You forgot all about. No, we got a highlight.
I didn't forget because I was about to say that's one highlight that you missed because I still have the JUCO record and the triple jump.
Yeah. Oh, well, man, come on, man. Your resume. You know, I won this meet that. I tried to get as much as I could, but no JUCO. I like highlighting that because that's a path that's often taken, and I mean a lot of world championship caliber athletes have gone through JUCO, you know, Barton or half, you know, all of you. We just interviewed Wallace recently, you know, the same thing. Like,
yeah,
you guys who went to Barton. Barton was insane back in the early 2000s.
Yeah, we were under Coach Brahman, and Coach Brahman had us right. And we got we had Veronica Campbell at the same time. We had Omar Brown. We had Tyson Gay.
Yeah.
Oh man, you can name them all. You know what I mean? Like all kind of future Olympians were, you know, were there, but came from Barton. All kind of Olympians and Olympic medalists and world medalists. You know, so hats off to Barton. You know what I mean?
What do you have to say about the JUCO? Like JUCO as an option for kids? You know, like they want as much information. Go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of people have this mixed information about it. Like, oh, I don't want to go to JUCO. I need to go to D1 first, but. In actuality, I feel like going to JUCO actually helped someone like me who was a little slower academically and not having to rush going into a major school like the Auburn where you just a number in the class. You know what I mean? So it kind of helps people mature. It helps you with that maturity level. Like you 2 years in a smaller school, then you go to a major D1 school. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it helps people like who, you know, who need help more and academically, you know?
Well, I mean, folks are going to JUCO for 2 years, then going to a major D1 college and they're being successful on the track and they're graduating with their degree. So they're obviously capable of doing the work.
Yeah, they are. But like I say, it's a level of maturity.
Yeah. give you a chance to develop and learn. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's not a bad thing. You know what I mean? Like, you know, a lot of people look down at going to junior college. But, you know, some of the greatest of greats came through junior college.
I know. I always see, and I know, Tabari, Tabari Henry, our Virgin Island Olympian. He's coaching now as well. And I always see him. He's kind of putting heat out there on social media. Like, he keep posting like lists of people. Like, what do you got? What are you saying about JUCOs? Like, are you sure JUCOs are not the way to go? Like, JUCO, you know, he's representing.
No, seriously. Yeah. Yeah. Tabari came through Biden too.
Yeah, exactly. And half of my, I had a couple teammates who went through, was it Casey? Then Kansas Christian.
Yeah. KCK.
Yeah, Rodney Martin and a couple others, they went through there. And then they came and joined us in South Carolina.
Yeah, that's where your boy was coaching. What's his name? He was to work with Coach Angel. We just were talking about him. He was there when you was there, right?
Where?
What's his name? Oh, he used to coach at KCK. He used to work with Coach Angel. He's assistant coach with Coach Angel last year, a year before last.
Really? I didn't know who that was. KCC.
Yeah, never mind. I can't remember right now.
But I know
his name. I just called his name just a while ago, and now I forgot. Eugene.
Okay, Eugene. Okay. Yeah, a lot of folks came through that system, man. KCK, what is it, South Plains, a few others that folks came through and did very well in D1. So it is a viable option for folks, and they shouldn't look down on it. Everyone has, you know, a different path. And so if this allows you more time to develop and, you know, get to a place and kind of work your way into how athletics and academics mesh at the college level, and it prepares you for, you know, a more intense environment, do what you got to do.
Yeah, you know, because, I mean, going straight to the big college don't work well for everybody, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. So you get to Auburn, you're kicking butt. And so what was the transition like? Actually, what was the transition like leaving the collegiate system and going pro?
I already had an office on the table. You know what I mean? But some people, it's, you know, it was a lot harder for them. You know what I mean? I came out as an NCAA champion. You know what I mean? So I've already had, you know, offers on the table, and, you know, major shoe companies was already trying to offer me deals. So it wasn't really a hard transition for me. You know what I mean? It's just a matter of picking and choosing which one I want to go with.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So, you know, and back then it was, you know, it was a lot easier to get contracts too. You know, back then it was easier than now, you know. But it was a smooth transition, I would say. I had to get used to not competing as much, or learning when to peak, or when, you know what I mean? But my coach is one who did the workouts, obviously. But he had already had experience coaching pros too, so he knew how to transition me into that aspect of, you know, like, you know, when you're in college, you competing every weekend, so you stay in shop. So yeah, I had to get better at not competing every weekend. So I guess what I was trying to say. Yeah. So that was the only aspect, I think, you know, but we mastered that, and, man, I was always ready, you know, for the major championships. Which was, you know, that's the only time, that's when you want to be ready, when you want to peak, you know?
Yeah, nah, you were definitely a competitor, man. You definitely used to, you definitely would show up, compete with some intensity too. Four Olympics. That makes you like an OG. You're a veteran, man. Four Olympics. You're a veteran.
I would think so.
And so that's a lot of experience at the Olympic Games, you know, something that the majority of people will never get to. I mean, competing in the Olympics is one thing. Four times is a whole nother thing. How would you summarize your Olympic experience? We have four Olympics in total.
I would say up and down. That's what I would say. You know, because I would say that because I went into my first Olympics you know, graduating from Auburn as a senior, 2204. But I also ran into the Olympics as number three ranked in the world. Mm-hmm. And my first Olympics, I didn't make the final. You know, so it was devastating for me, you know. And then, you know, you feel that pressure of, oh, he's number three in the world, so he's one of the favorites to win a medal. Mm-hmm. So my next time around, I think I took an approach different. And in my first Olympics, I was walking around excited to meet all these different stars that I grew up seeing, like, you know what I mean, all these big-time sprinters and stuff. So I think I was on my legs a lot, just being excited, just, you know, being excited just to be an Olympian, you know? And so I walked around a lot, and you know, I think I might kill my legs a little bit. So my second time around, my approach was different. We had a training camp. So we did the training camp thing, and then we was over there a little longer before competition. And I wasn't walking around as much. And we didn't go into the Games Village until later, too, like the week before competition. Mm-hmm. So I think my coach took a different approach that time. And I was better prepared physically and mentally, you know what I mean? And that's why I was able to pull off the bronze. You know what I mean? And then another, you know, what I say, up and down roller coaster. And next time around, I was one of the favorite again to win the medal, and blew my knee out. And so, and that's what I mean, you know, it was just up and down. And it took me 2 years of rehab to get back to full form. And to, you know, it was tough, you know what I mean? And to not have a coach and not have an agent, and still go and qualify for the next Olympics, I think it's remarkable, you know?
Mm-hmm. But I think that you like kind of went through everything very quickly. Like you gave us a snapshot of everything, because even though your first Olympics was 2004, you were already a world championship medalist by then. Mm-hmm. So you right. already tapped into a certain mindset, but going from NCAA to pros and seeing you not make the final, what was that on your mental?
Oh yeah, that was tough. I mean, I got lost. I was lost. I disappeared. Nobody could find me. You know what I mean? Because I'm the type of athlete that, you know, I have high expectations. You know, and so I'd already envisioned myself, you know, coming in as number three and as this, a bronze medalist the year before. I already had this vision. I already visualized myself, you know, being on top again. You know, and sometimes, you know. You know, when that don't happen, then, you know, you get down on yourself and you get disappointed, and you know what I mean? It was just tough. It was a tough, you know, and I'm not used to not making the finals. Coming from NCAAs, I was always in the finals. You know, I was always a contender, you know? And so that was a humbling experience, you know, at the same time. And so I told myself I would never let it happen again. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
I think that part is what I was trying to get out, like the humbling experience, because sometimes that, you know, we're so talented, we're so this and that, but sometimes it takes us to kind of like fall to make sure that we are still motivated and still hitting our targets, because sometimes we could take certain things for granted.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Like, yeah, you know, you have those certain targets, and then sometimes you hit it, and then some people, they go into a shell. Mm-hmm. And then they can't blossom. They can't blossom again. You know what I mean? So I was always the type that, you know, it happens. I'm going to be down right now for a couple of days or months or whatever. But then I'm going to use this experience to help motivate me to push past this again. And so to, you know, make sure that it doesn't happen again, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yep. Great. I always see the patterns here in these conversations. It is at this point, I'm just 100% convinced that there's just a recipe to success, period. Like you got, I'm seeing the same stuff over and over. And for the folks who actually listen to this podcast, you have to be hearing the same stuff over and over again. All right. So what I hear, you went into your first Olympics and you were already good. You were already good. Just like Coach Tanja, she was good. You know, just like Dwight Phillips when he was getting second place all the time. He was good. And even then, to get to that next level, to make sure that you got that bronze the next time, it was like, I'm not missing the finals.
No.
You said that. The whole mindset. It was like a decision you made. I'm not missing the finals. And I hear that, just like Dwight, I'm not getting second again, you know. Coach Tanja, I'm going to win the next one. I'm not getting third. I'm winning. I'm breaking the record. Like,
right.
Even if you're already at a level of success, you can still break through, but it doesn't happen by accident. It doesn't happen by just continuing to do what you've been doing. It happens by stopping and making a decision. This is what I'm going to do. And then go do it. So that's what I heard. And yeah. I love hearing it because this is every time. The other thing I'm hearing is, and just like everyone else's story, you know, this stuff is a constant. It isn't you're trying to achieve success and then you got it and then you win. It's a constant cycle of you've win, you lose, and you're constantly learning and going and improving. Yeah. Like
the mountain.
Exactly. And it doesn't stop. So it just has to be how you live your life. So you got a bronze, you're at the top, and then 4 years later, you're committing yourself to this thing. And bam, you blow out your knee at the 2012 games.
Yep.
You tear your patella tendon. And yep. If anyone hasn't seen that video, which I mean, that was, it's hard to watch because you're going after it. You're like, yo, I'm going, you're going after it. And all of a sudden, bam, your leg just buckles. Right. And it's like, you just put 4 years in to where you got third last time. So you're coming into this meet like, I'm about to win. And then this happened. And now it's like, where am I from? Where do I go from here?
Right. And so, people don't understand too. Yeah. People don't understand too. Like I tell people, like, I knew it was partially torn the jump before that, you know?
Yeah. I heard that.
Yeah. So it was like, you know, it's the Olympics, you know what I mean? You're going to stop. I didn't even tell my coach. I was like, you know what? This is what I told myself. I said, you know what? Today, my knee is going to have to break today. And then next jump, wow, bro.
But that's what it, and that's another thing that, man, people got to hear that. That is what it takes to win. I'm sorry. Life ain't fair. It sounds harsh.
Yeah.
But he had a 50-50 chance. Destroy my knee or jump 60 feet. Like, I'm going to win this thing.
Yep.
And so I'm committed to whatever happens. I'm going to give it my best. And yo, your knee went out, but it was like, you put everything out there and you could have had a big, it could have not went out and you had the biggest jump in the meet.
Biggest jump.
That could have happened.
That was at the edge of the runway. If you look at it, I was at the edge of the runway.
Yeah, you on the track. You in the middle of the curve, you know? Like, so it's like, you know, but that's what it takes. So if you're at home afraid to take a chance to get this job, or take a chance to win this race, or take a chance to do something, and you're not willing to go as hard as he just described, where you're willing to just, hey, look, my leg break, it break. It is what it is. Then don't think you're entitled to winning anything, because there are people out there who are going to go as hard as he's talking about right here. A lot of people.
Hungry.
There's hungry people out there. This is what it is. Hey, you know? So you go out there. So now, bam. Knee's done, you know, they're carrying you off the track. So where are you mentally now?
After this, I'm like, I tell him, my dad was right there in the ambulance with me. And I sitting up there crying. I said, Daddy, I let the Bahamas down. You know, this is my thought process. You know what I mean? I wanted to bring home the gold for my country. You know what I mean? That's what I was focused on. And he's telling me, he say, son, you didn't let nobody down. You give it your all, you know? Mm-hmm. You give it your all. And I feeling down, like, oh, man, I let everybody down. I didn't get the medal. Everybody expected me to bring it. They know when it comes to bringing home the medal, they know that I'm always fighting for that medal for the country, you know what I mean? And so I tell her, you know, I get into the hospital and stuff like that, and I ask some questions. I tell the doctor, I say, hey, I don't care what you say or anybody say. I'm coming back. And doctor told me right there, he said, listen, that's the attitude that you have to have. A lot of people haven't came back from this injury, but you have the right attitude. And he just met me for the first time. Mm. You know what I'm saying? And so from there, I already knew that I was going to make a comeback, even though a lot of people didn't believe it was possible. And, you know, people gave up on me and people said, oh, I need to retire. Oh, yeah, okay. That's your opinion. You know what I mean? Everybody have their own opinion. And suffer, right? But people's opinions never matter to me, you know what I mean? Because I have my own goals that I want to achieve. See what I'm saying? So it doesn't matter what nobody say about me, say to me. You know, it doesn't really matter because that's you. That's not me. So I have my own goals. And watch me. I want all of y'all to watch me achieve that goal.
Yeah.
Even the ones who gave up on me. People who was even there by my side for 9 years, 10 years, who gave up and didn't think it was possible. I had to show them. I show every last one of them, like, you know what I'm saying, the possibility of what you of believing in yourself and trusting, you know, and having faith and trusting God, you know what I mean? That's all it is.
That is the mindset of a winner. I know for some reason this day and age, winner is charged language because it makes things competitive, but unfortunately life is competitive. And, you know, I'm listening to you and it's always the same, right? We interviewed Jaime Nieto, right? High jumper, who he was told that he would only gain 30% functionality back after he was paralyzed from the neck down. And he walked on his wedding day, right? And, you know, there's so many stories when you talk to Olympic medalists, especially. It's this unique group of people, you know, who just have crazy drive, right? This exceptional drive. Yeah. And all of them, I'm hearing stories like this where they were told they would never do something again. This would never happen again. Even a young man who I coach, who's the Spanish national record holder, Bruno, tore his, you know, he got in a car accident. You know, his hand almost amputated. His knees were torn up. And he came back and broke the Spanish national record after a year and a half of not running. And so it's like, there's always a doctor saying you can't accomplish anything, but you can't really quantify heart and willpower and all these things that have physical impact on your recovery, but you can't really quantify it. Like you can't add it up. Like, you know, they could look at your numbers and say, this is the injury you have. This is how long it usually takes to heal that injury. In a normal human, but, you know, when I think if you're talking to someone who's an Olympian, who has a mindset, who believes in manifesting, who believes in the power of the mind, who has experienced the power of the mind, if you're an athlete, and so you're like, oh, well, you're telling me I'm never going to walk again. I don't buy that. I'm not believing that. Exactly. That's not going to happen. And
So, I'm not type. I use it. I use whatever you say. You better be careful what you tell me.
Hey, yeah, I'm going to use it. It's a chip on my shoulder now. They told me I would never do this again. That's all.
I'm telling you, I always tell people, be careful what you tell me. I'm going to show you.
I know folks, it's so funny. I know some folks who do that intentionally. They wait for someone to say something that's not even like that, but they'll use
that's
it.
Me.
Like,
wait.
You said I couldn't do this? You said I couldn't do this. Perfect.
That's me.
So, that's me. So, how was this?
That's where the zero excuses. That's where the zero excuses only results came from. Mm-hmm. With the brand, you know what I mean? Zero excuses, only results, you know what I mean? So
zero excuses, only results.
Yeah.
What was the recovery like? What was your recovery process like and your comeback to competition?
Oh, man. I think I briefly touched on it, but it was painful, excruciating, you know what I mean? And, man, when I take my mind back there, it's like, I wonder, and sometimes I wondered, you know, even though I had a strong mind and the will to come back, at some point I had some questions, you know, like, can I really do this? You know what I mean? That's how painful it was. You know what I mean? Like, I went from not being able to walk, I had to build muscle and, trying to get my knee to bend past 90 degrees. Man, that was something. You know what I mean? The recovery was no joke, to be honest. You know what I mean? But, like I say, I had good people behind me, you know what I mean? My family was behind me on that, and they kept on trying to help me, you know, push through, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I just kept going until I was able to do certain things that I wanted to do. You know, even though it took a year for me to even be able to run properly, you know, my knee was just always stuck. It was like kind of like stuck at one, at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to constantly be bending my, you know, going to rehab and them bending my knee and until I was able to be more flexible to do it on my own, you know.
Yeah.
And one year is a long time. And along with that, I was doing PRP treatment with Hank Sloan, my other doctor, and Cumming, Georgia. So I would go down maybe once or twice a month and we would do PRP injections. So I took a lot. I did a lot of injections, vitamin injections, and stuff like that to help the healing process go faster. And you know, mm-hmm. I think that helped me a lot too. you know, to get by quicker and to strengthen that tendon, you know. But and then coming back to competition would have been this. I got injured 2012. Coming back, the competition would have been 2014, where I just decided to do some long jump meets. So I qualified for Commonwealth. It was a Commonwealth 2014 Commonwealth. I went to 2014 Commonwealth. I just did long jump. Yeah, I don't think I don't remember. I don't think I made the finals in the long jump though, but because I haven't long jumped in so long. And so it was the following year that I decided to triple jump. I wanted to give it at least 2 years before I started jumping on my knee again. And then I remember the first meet I went to. I even though I was practicing the whole time, I jumped and practiced a few times, you know what I mean? And it was just when the meet started and I hear, you know, and people started clapping, I visualized myself getting hurt. Like I saw myself run down the runway and get injured because that was the last time I had competed in front of a crowd. So I remember looking down the runway and actually, you know, people clapping and I saw myself get injured at the end of the runway. So when I ran down the runway and I hopped, it was the quickest step I ever did in my life. Yeah, because I was kind of nervous, you know what I mean? My first competition, I was nervous. And then it took a couple of meets after that for me to, you know, to get over that and build my confidence back, you know, and then and I started going up from there. I qualified at some point during that time, that year, 2015, my first year triple jumping, I actually jumped 1680 and I qualified for the Pan Am Games in Toronto. And I went and I got, even though, I feel like some members of our federation didn't want me to go because they didn't think I was capable of winning the medal or whatever their thoughts were. But anyway, I ended up going last minute. I finally got a call probably like a couple of days before the competition started. So I fought my way on the team and I got on the team, got a silver medal. And I jumped 1699 and qualified me for World Champs in Beijing.
There's always some hater who never did any sports talking about, oh, he shouldn't go. Like, who? There's always somebody. Some old Grinch. Hater. Can't even get out. Can't run anywhere. Can't jump anywhere. Never won anything. But going to say, you not ready to do it. Man, there's always somebody. Necessary for a good movie.
They were trying to block it.
Non-track people a little perspective on the recovery that you just went through briefly. Triple jump is not it is very demanding on your knees, to say the least. If you watch the triple jump, the amount of force that you're applying that your knee has to accommodate, you know, your knee, your quad, your hamstring, and coming back from a patella injury, I know you have to spend a lot of time rehabilitating your quads, getting them strong again, so that they can support your knee, and even the impact that the hamstring takes when planning. I mean, it's not just running. It's a lot of force. I mean, I wish I had numbers of how many pounds, you know, someone your height and weight is applying to the ground. But I'm sure we're talking 1,000 pounds of force. I'm sure we're talking 1,000 pounds of force on that knee.
The body weight, that's crazy.
Yeah, the speed, the fact that you're covering some ground and then that force into the ground, that's 1,000 easy. And so it's like being able to get to the point where you can jump again to where you're comfortable doing that, that's going to be tough. And it's smart, very, very smart. People hearing this, he didn't rush it. He started out with what? The long jump, something that's demanding, but not quite as demanding as the triple jump. And so he worked his way. Exactly. It's not going to be as demanding as exactly. So you worked your way, you took your time and you built yourself back. And when you recovered, you were able to, you know, continue to compete at a high level.
Yeah.
And it's hard, you know. It was hard, you know, coming back. When I came back, you know, people were saying, oh, no, he's finished. And you know, you have to deal with all that too. So as an athlete, you have to know how to deal with those type of people, you know, who always want to say you can't do it or there's no way he could come back from that injury. You know what I mean? So stuff like that you would hear. And so, you know, that's why you got to be so self-motivated, you know what I mean? And to be able to push yourself past those negative vibes, you know?
Yeah, Trayvon Bermell heard the same thing, I'm sure, you know?
Yeah. I was going to ask, because after 2012, you had already had your Olympic medal, you had your world medal. Like, you have solidified you as a legend in the Bahamas. Woo. And going through that injury, what were some of the conversations about, like, I'm going to really try to come back? Because you had nothing to prove at that point.
Yeah, I didn't have anything to prove, you know, seeing that I still haven't gotten an Olympic gold. So that was always my thing in the back of my head. So I just felt like I could have gotten a gold medal, you know what I mean? So, and I think 2012, I was in great shape, and I think I had an opportunity if I didn't get injured, I felt like I had an opportunity to probably win the gold in 2012 Olympics. But that was always my thing. I didn't win the gold medal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, regardless of what people thought or the conversation I had with people, and they might think, oh, and they saw the injury, or, you know, but that's people's opinion. So I always had this, my dream is a gold medal. So I was sticking to my own belief and my own dream to go back and get this gold medal, you know? So that's what kept my drive going. Gold medal. Yeah. Yeah.
And you were definitely passionate. I know from experience, just like seeing, I think it was in 2017 or 2018 in Bahamas, and I think you were going to retire. And like all the emotions and everything came out. And it's just like, dude, this dude loves this sport for real. And just seeing you come back again, it's like, bro, sit down. Like, what else do you have to prove? So it's crazy that you keep finding that motivation. So like, what are some things that you would tell other people, like if you're coaching them? Like, how do you find that inner voice, that inner drive to keep going?
Well, I mean, like I said, you know, it's based on, you know, on their belief on what they want to do. You know, if you're going to listen to somebody say, tell you, you need to retire or you need to stop or you can't do it, or you're going to follow your own goals and dreams and aspirations, you know what I mean? So I would just tell them, like, follow your own goals. I mean, people are going to say, in my experience, people are going to talk about you if you're doing good or bad anyway. So to me, it don't really matter no more. You know what I mean? Like, it never mattered to me what someone thought or, you know, if that's their opinion. You know what I mean? And that's how I take it through life. And I try to train my athletes the same way. You know what I mean? I'm not going to, as a coach, all I know is that I'm never going to give up on you or give up on none of them. You know what I mean? Because I know what it feels like for a coach to give up on you. And you know what I mean? So that's something that I think I'll always be there for my athletes for. Like, you know, if they have a goal, I'm going to try. But it doesn't matter. You know, I'm going to always be there to guide them to there or help them get to where they need to accomplish. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you can never listen to the haters. I mean, I think Brittany Reese was saying the same thing. People telling her to throw in the towel. Like, okay. Yeah, she's about to get another goal real quick.
What?
Hey.
What?
Same thing with Levando, because he'll be like, oh, he needs to retire. Then Nationals come and he'll like beat all them little kids. And like,
yeah, of course.
Like, sit somewhere.
Yeah, hey, I feel the same way about Chirandi. I'm like, are you just going to keep winning your national championship, man? Let someone else, let the young boys come in, man.
Yeah, and that's the mentality, though. It's the mentality of some Caribbean people. Like, they feel like, oh, because, you know, you've been talked about and you've been around for so long, oh, it's time for you to hang it up and let the young people get a chance.
Nah. They got to earn it. This is track and field, okay? And just like people who say what they want, it's like Gatlin, right? He going to run as long as he could win. Now people starting to give him some heat, right? But that's what it takes. Some youngins got to step up to the plate and decide they're going to retire some folks.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's the bottom line. Yeah. You know what I mean? And my thing is, why not encourage somebody if they want to keep going? Then okay, Merle and Audie. I mean, look at those Merle and Audie. When she's what? How old Merle Audie? What, she's in her 40s, right?
Hey, man,
she runs forever.
Hey man, Kim ran 9.9 at 40. So I, you know,
that's what I'm saying.
PR. So you got, you can't, you know. This isn't the old days. This is 2021, man. You can go. You can go. I'm waiting for you to come out here and you know, go in and get this medal, man. This comeback 2.0.
Don't
you're still training, right?
He's training.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still training. It's still training.
Hey, man.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just like coaching. You know, when you're coaching, it's just hard to train and coach at the same time. And
I tried that. It's too hard, man. Because you're paying attention to the kids. Like, you might do one rep, and then you're 20 minutes of watching them, correcting them, and you're like, man, I only did one rep. I can't even, you know.
Exactly. That's what happens.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I tried it. It's you're like, man. But what happens is the coaching replaces you being an athlete. Like, now, if I have a kid on the line, I feel as nervous as I was on the start line.
That's how I am now, too.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I am. Yeah, one of my athletes calling me right now from South Africa. Yep.
There you go, coach. So you're coaching now. You're coaching now at University of Northern Colorado. Jumps.
Mm-hmm.
Jumps.
About it? I didn't hear the last part. You break up.
You're coaching at Northern Colorado right now.
Yeah.
So you transition into the coaching game. You're still training, but you transition into the coaching game. And how do you like being in that position now? Because you were an athlete being coached, and you know how your perspective was as an athlete. But now in the coach's chair, you know, what are your thoughts now? Do you like coaching? Or you know?
Yeah, I think I've always enjoyed coaching. Like I say, I've had experience with my club. I had a club in Auburn.
Yeah.
So I had experience coaching different all ages, you know what I mean? So I've always enjoyed it, and it feels the same way. So when they are successful, it almost feels the same, like what you were saying, you know what I mean? It feels the same.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I get the same feeling, the same jitters when they about to compete, like I'm about to jump, you know what I mean? you know what I mean? Like, you don't want them to foul, and if they have a fouling problem, you got to know how to fix it. It's the same, it feels the same, you know? You get that same rush.
You heard it here, folks. Superman saying that he gets the jitters before he jumps. See that?
Mm-hmm.
Even Superman can get a little nervous.
Say what?
Even Superman can get a little nervous.
But you can't show it, though. You can't show it. You
can't show it, but it better be there. If you don't feel that, yeah.
Yeah, you feel something. You feel something, but you got to scream it out or something. I got to scream it out. You know what I mean? I got to let it out. You know what I mean? Scream. So that's what I do. That's how I get rid of my nervousness. So I think other athletes, they gotta find that. Some, you know, like females, they keep everything in, but I find that it helps when you kind of let it out. That's what my daddy taught me. He taught me, you know, that he did karate. He was a black belt, and it's something that they call it, I think, the gi. And you let it out, and then you all the nervousness just go. You know what I mean? And he taught, that's something that he taught me. That's why I'm probably one of those jumpers you would have screaming the most. You know what I mean? I make a lot of noise on the runway. You know what I mean? So that's me getting out that nervousness. Ha, let's go. You know? So I getting it out of the way, you know?
Well, I like seeing that, because athletes will switch up, you know. It'll be the most quiet, you know, introverted athletes, but when they get on the line, you know, it's a whole different beast.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Definitely. Yeah, because I'm a different person. People are, I have friends who always tell me, they're like, who the hell is that on the runway?
You hype on the runway.
I'm a different person. I mean, I tell you, it's like Jekyll and Hyde, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah, the nice person is Jekyll, that's me right now, you know, chilling off the track. But then, you know, you know what I mean? Then the bad person comes over and they get on the track. You know what I mean? Like, the beast, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the mentality that I try to, you know, try to teach my kids or my athletes, you know, that mentality, you know, that beast mentality when you're on the track, that, you know, have that confidence to know that, look, like, I step on the track as a, like, I'm the winner. You know what I mean? Like, I have the mentality that, look, nobody here could beat me.
Yeah.
So I try to teach or train them to be that same way, to have that type of confidence. It's a cocky, you know, some people might say I was cocky.
No. Yes. No, I'm glad you said that, because I don't know. Yeah, see, that we got to get this cocky thing out. We're going to bring this to the forefront. Okay. Okay. Let's name
multiple people have said cocky.
Let's name some, but Muhammad Ali, you know, Bolt. I mean, I like Bolt. Bask in My Glory. I mean, who do you know who's the best at anything who don't think and act like they're the best at that thing? You don't get there without thinking that you're best. Now, you don't have to be a monster. You don't have to go around, slap someone in the back of the head. I'm better than you. But in your mind and how you walk and how you move, you better reflect that you think that you are number one. There's no other way. So I don't want to hear, oh, you got to be humble. Who? You could be humble in your actions and how you're respecting and dealing with people. But if you want to win anything and you want to be the best at anything, you better go into that thing already thinking you're the best. I don't know what to tell you.
So that's the problem I've had over the years where people would meet me for the first time. And then they would say, man, I thought you're different from what I thought. I thought you was cocky and, you know, unapproachable. You know what I mean? I'm like, no, man, I say you getting it mixed up. You getting it confused. That's me in competition. So out of competition, I'm a totally different person. You know what I mean? So some people don't understand. They feel like you are the way you compete. Like they feel like that's how you are, like in person.
Yeah, man.
Now there's so many nice track and field athletes. I'd be like, that person is a nice person in real life. Like they quiet, nice. It's just you know, they're gonna be an animal when they compete.
But when you come on, like, this is my job. I'm focused on one thing today is not to be your friend.
But I mean, we're in track. We're in a sport where you're off by just a little bit mentally. You're done. You know. I like to say kind of like boxing, right? Like if you go into that ring and anywhere in your mind is that I'm going to get knocked out, you're done. Guaranteed. Now you may get knocked out anyway, but if you go in there thinking it, guaranteed.
Yeah.
Like, it's just sports, man. And it's life in general. If you go into that job interview thinking that you're going to mess up and you're not going to get the job, don't expect to get the job because you're going to fulfill that prophecy.
Yeah. Right, you going in with the wrong attitude. You know what I mean? You got to be confident. You know what I mean, can't be scared. You know? So my dad used to say, "Never scared." And so when I say that, I mean when you see that, that's when the animal comes out.
So what do you think about? You know, you've been to four Olympics. This year is going to be crazy with all of the restrictions. No spectators. You know, Japan is going through it. They don't even want to host it. Trying to get some more current events here because, you know, folks want to know. So what's your opinion on the Olympic experience this year? Because me personally, I'm not going. And I don't want to say, because I don't want to be like, oh, I don't want to go. But I just know that the experience there is not going to be the same. Not being able to see the country, experience the culture, being able to fellowship with the other athletes, exchange pins and jackets and all those things that make that coming together, the Olympic experience kind of special for the athletes, at least the participants. You know, you were a flag bearer in the closing ceremonies of was that 2016?
2016.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's gonna. So, what are your thoughts on the Olympics this year and what that experience would be like?
Yeah, I honestly feel like it's, you know, with COVID stuff, it's gonna kill the experience, especially for people going for the first time. You know what I mean? Like, we have a lot of newcomers. It's not gonna be the experience like the Beijing and Athens and even London, or they're not going to get that experience. And then, two, I mean, as a jumper, you know, we feed off the crowd. You know what I mean? So, I mean, I'm sure other events, or most all the events, feed off the crowd. You know what I mean? It helps boost the performance. You know what I mean? You get a crowd roaring. You know, so that's another thing. You know, and then now, you know, cases rise and stuff like that. And so, even though some people might be there, they still might not get the opportunity to even compete because they got to quarantine or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think this is a tough situation. And I just, you know, honestly, I wasn't really feeling it, you know, just per se. You know, I feel like it wasn't going to be, you know, what I've experienced in the past. You know what I mean?
I think it's a teaching of gratitude because, you know, all of us have competed at Olympic Games and had that experience. And now going to see like what it's going to be like. And we're not sure if it's ever going to be the same.
Right.
Like I was a flag bearer at the last Olympics, and I would post pictures or videos, and they'd be like, "Wow, that is crazy. That is not going to be that." And I'm like, it's serious. Like, it's not going to be just like with that hype, with the crowd. Brazil was behind of us. So, you know, Brazil fans were throwing stuff. They were like right on top of the roof. It was crazy. It was really crazy. And knowing that you're not going to have that experience is a lesson in gratitude, like live in the moment and really take it all in at that time, because you just never know what can happen next time.
So that's real.
And then I also had a little bit of commentary because I wanted to ask you about the Sakari situation. Being that, you know, in the past you had your suspension and it was just for a Vicks inhaler. Do you think it would have been any different with social media? And do you think that, you know, WADA has to adjust some of their stipulations and rules?
Yeah, I mean, I think with social media, it probably been different. I probably wasn't even on social media like that back in 2006.
2006,
it
was
something so, yes,
sir.
Right.
Not Instagram and things.
That was it. So, I mean, it might have been different, you know what I mean? But when you look at what it was and the severity of the suspension, it didn't really make sense. And I also lost my contract with Adidas for something simple like that, you know what I mean? And honestly, I don't blame the IAAF or WADA for that, because they gave me clear details that it was really nothing, and it's up to my federation to give me from a public warning to a year suspension. But they decided after 6 months of putting me through this tribunal, which is unnecessary, because after the second sample we discovered it was only just a Vicks inhaler. But they decided they wanted to teach me a lesson. And they suspended me for 6 months, which in now the 6 months was almost up by the time as I did my tribunal. So they tried to say, oh, it was a slap on the wrist. So they put me through that. And knowing that, because in my tribunal, I stated that, you know, okay, I made a mistake. It was a Vicks inhaler, something I grew up using. It's not a performance enhancement. So I'm telling y'all now, if I get a day suspension, I'm going to lose my contract. And they politely told me in the tribunal, one of the guys there told me, he said, well, I can promise you that you're going to keep your contract, but you should have known better. So right there and then I knew I was going to get suspended. Mm-hmm. And I lost my contract with Adidas.
Yeah. You know? So just imagine if you were able to share that type of story on a platform as big as you have now.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I talked about it all the time. And during that time, people don't understand what that did for me, you know what I mean? What that did to me, because I was in complete devastation. I was suicidal. I remember I went home for like a few months, you know, I just was out of it, you know what I mean? Because to hear people talk about me, like to say, oh, I always knew he was on steroids.
Yo, that's the worst.
So I had to deal with that every day, you know, and I just signed my contract. I only been with Adidas for like 1 year. Mm-hmm. I just signed, and these people are already telling me, oh, you should have known better, and then suspended me. And I got the call saying I'm going to lose my contract. I was like, oh, wow. You know what I mean? I lost everything. I mean, I lost my contract. I couldn't get a deal next year. Couldn't get a deal. I remember I went to the indoor championship. I actually qualified for Japan in 07. I didn't make the finals there. You know, trying to compete to get a contract back. Didn't happen. No deals. And in 2008 indoors, I went to the indoor worlds and didn't make the finals there. You know, I didn't get a deal. And then, finally, I started talking to Yuka, sending an agent, and he finally got me a little small deal. I signed for $5,000 a year with Mizuno in 2008, before Olympics. This was indoors. And then, you know, I started jumping well. After the indoors, I started jumping well because there was an article came out about me from, you know, it's be your own people, you know. your own people. So this article came out saying, since they didn't say Vixen Hill now, he said, since Divine Science drug suspension, he has been on a downward movement, and it seems like it's the end for Superman.
Lord.
And so I read that article, man. I was home, and I went to my parents' room. It was late one night, and I was telling my dad, I don't understand why I trying to make a comeback just 2 years later, and they still bringing this up like I was on some steroids or something. And I cried. You know what I mean? And I'm the type of person, I don't cry, you know. I'm one of the toughest people.
What? You know, you told us you cry about 3 times in this interview.
I know. But so. they're tough things I've been through, though.
Yeah, I agree.
These were tough things. I mean, I've been an athlete from 5 or 6 years old, and to hear people say you was on steroids just because you were sick and you used a Vicks inhaler, something that you grew up using and not thinking to write it down on the sheet, on the form. And then for people to say, you know, and then what was the mess up thing about it? When they first made the first call and they called my coach, they said methamphetamine.
Yeah, of course they did.
So at the time I didn't know, we didn't even know what methamphetamine was, right? So I looking up methamphetamine and I methamphetamine, crystal meth.
You out here smoking crystal meth before
street,
you jump.
Yeah, a street drug. I was like, what? So it wasn't until we did the B sample. So my federation, what they did, they went, so when after the first, they got the first call, they went and broadcasted it. The president went and talked about it before finding out what it really was. Mm-hmm. And so all of this, I going through.
Unmute. You muted yourself. There you go.
I'm young, going through this. And, you know, the article, like I say, going back to the article came out saying that this was 2008, that's the end of Superman. And that's when I thought about it, and I was like, you know what? I'm not going to let, because of what somebody think, make me, force me into quitting or retiring or whatever. So
yeah.
I started training harder than ever, and I started doing better. I was in a different state of mind at that point, because I thinking about what he said. You know what I mean? And prior to the Olympics, I started doing some meets in Brazil. You know, this was the first meets, the circuit I could have gotten on. You know, and going to Brazil, started bouncing, jumped over 17 meters for the first time since 2006. And that's when I started going up. And then I went to Beijing, and I qualified for Beijing. I went to the trials. I must be jumped like 17:40 something on my first jump at trials. You know, and I throw sand everywhere. I was throwing sand. I was acting like the fool. I was crazy.
Sound like that hate with some motivation, brother.
Oh, yeah. That was fun. I get out of the pit, and I was roaring like a lion, throwing sand. I was freaking out, you know, because I've been through so much. You know what I mean? At this point, I was so hurt about the situation because I lost everything for nothing.
You did. But it did. Even with that, it doesn't sound like... It sounded like you took accountability for it, though. It sounded like you're like, hey, look, I should have, like, I didn't hear you blaming anyone just now.
No, I didn't blame no one. I told them, I say, look, this is what happened. I didn't write it down because I didn't think it was necessary, because it's just an over the counter. The Vicks inhaler you put in your nose. I didn't think it would have caused a failed test. You know what I mean?
I
accepted it. I say, look, you know, it was a mistake. You know, you guys could give me, they could give me a warning. It's an easy warning they could have do. They could have just say, hey, yeah, man, just give him a warning.
And they didn't have to destroy you. They didn't have to destroy you.
Not for that.
But in my mind, that's a very different situation from Shikari's, who you took something inadvertently. They figured out what it was. You still got penalized for it. She took something deliberately that we all know is on this list. I mean, you can look up how many people done lost medals for smoking. You know, I mean, there's plenty of people who done lost medals, rankings, everything.
That was a lot. Yeah. I mean, get it's a bad situation. Yeah, I get it too.
You're in Eugene. I get it. You can get it right around the corner. But I just feel, you know, and I hear most track people kind of saying this type of argument. It sounds like the non-track people who's like, let her run. In my mind, should, you know, cannabis be on USADA's list? Well, it has to be because it's on WADA's list. Should it be on WADA's list? It has to be because weed is still illegal in over 100 countries. The majority of countries is still illegal. So just because it's legal in Cali, Oregon, Colorado, New York, doesn't mean that it's legal in India and, you know, in Saudi Arabia and all these other countries, the UK, all these other places is still illegal. And so it's going to be on the USADA list. And as long as it's there, we can't do anything about it. That's how how I think where we're at. So even if they let her on the USA team, she gets to the Olympics and then what?
Yeah, she do it again. Yeah.
They're going, it's still in your blood.
I think it's more acceptable now, you know what I mean? And
it is.
They should put some thought to that situation, because I think some people use it for medicinal use, and it helps a lot of people, you know. I think it would have been hard for her to get off of that because of the situation, because other people got suspended for the same thing, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think that's why they had to do that, you know what I mean? I feel like, you know, because other people got suspended, I feel like they couldn't just say, okay, yeah, you could go and run, you know what I mean? So she just had to suffer with those circumstances, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I just feel like, you know, they can do a study on seeing whether it's truly performance enhancing, which I don't think it's performance enhancing. You know, I've heard people say you're more relaxed, which relaxation during sprinting is beneficial. But as long as it's still like a, whatever it is, schedule 4 federally, like it's still too illegal in too many places for us. That's the problem. Right. There needs to be a discussion globally probably, but unfortunately, that ain't happening this year.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no. Well, that's cool.
I forgot who it was back in the day who kept getting banned, man. Was it like Bernard Williams? It was some, I don't want to even put that on anyone's name.
Put that out there.
But it feels like that. I don't want to say Capel. I don't want to get no one mad at me, but there were a couple cats back in the day, man. They kept getting weed bans. You're like, bruh, stop, please.
Yeah.
But I know Levon has another meeting to get to.
At 2:00, yes. I have to drive.
Yeah. So you definitely gave us some good time out of his busy schedule.
Yeah, I appreciate it. We definitely
more
appreciate
about your business, but before you go, just tell us, you know, about your business, your brand, and where we could find it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So my brand, it came from, you know, my dad is also Levon's son too as well. So, the wings on, you know, the logo came from my jump, obviously my jump from the Olympic Games when I won my bronze medal, the silhouette of it. And the wings is from my daddy, who always told me he was saw like a phoenix. You know what I mean? So that's where the wings come from. That surrounds my actual silhouette. And so, you know, this came about four years ago. Mm-hmm. About 4 years ago, started the brand and came up with the zero excuses on the results. And I always wanted to have my own brand. You know, even I always said that whenever I don't have a contract, I want to have my own brand to where I want to sponsor athletes who don't have a shoe contract. So that was one of my goals, you know, and it started from then 4 years ago. And now I have my website, sanspro apparel.com. You can check out the website. And also my Instagram at sanspro apparel. Yeah. And then my personal website, my personal Instagram is Ivan Sans or Superman Sans. And obviously my coaching page, Coach Levon Sans on Instagram. So, that's it.
All right. So make sure you all go follow Levon, you know, show your support. Absolutely go buy some merchandise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, zero excuses, only results.
Zero excuses, only results. I like that.
Yeah.
We definitely appreciate you coming on and sharing your story. You know, one of the best ever, one of the best triple jumpers, period. One of the best athletes coming out of the Bahamas and the Caribbean, period, man. I know the Caribbean, we're all proud of you. Ignore the haters, you know. You represented the Caribbean well, man, on the world stage. And,
appreciate
you know,
that.
something to be proud of. And, you know, oh, as usual, ignore the haters. Because all they can do is
yes. He inspired someone today. So thank you again.
Yes, no problem. Appreciate you guys. It. Thank you, son.
Take care of yourself. Until next time.
All right. Y'all be blessed.
You too. Take care.